everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're very pleased to have Andrew Gentes on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, Exile to Siberia, 1590 to 1822. Siberia has a kind of bad rap insofar as being exiled and being sent to Siberia are synonyms, even in English, which is kind of a remarkable thing if you think about it. I had some impression as to how Siberia got this rap, but didn't know the full details. Andrew fills us in. I enjoyed talking to him, and I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Andrew.
Good morning, Marshall.
And how are you today?
I'm doing very well. How about yourself?
I'm very well. It's very kind of you not to say that this is the second time we started this, because I screwed up the first time. So but we will not burden the listeners with that. Let me just say to them that we're very happy to have Andrew Gentes on the show today, and we'll be talking about his terrific new book, Exile to Siberia, 1590 to 1822. I should tell people that this is a topic that's very close to my own heart, not because I was exiled to Siberia or anything like that, but because much of Andrew's work falls directly into the period that I once studied, that is the Muscovite period. So I was particularly enthused to read this book, and I encourage everybody to read it as well. So, Andrew, maybe we could begin by you telling me and our listeners a little bit about yourself, that is, where you grew up, where you went to school, and how you became interested in Russian history.
Yeah, sure. And thanks a lot for that introduction, by the way, Marshall. Well, I was born in New Hampshire, and when I was a kid, my dad was in the military, and so we moved around a fair amount. But for the most part, I was born and raised and received my education in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
Went to little Keene State College down there in southwestern New Hampshire, mm-hmm. and at that time, for what I confess was a kind of a small-town kid, that was really probably a good place for me to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't too old and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And by virtue of going there, I was able to be a little bit of a big fish in a small pond, I suppose, and
mm-hmm.
there was a low teacher-to-student ratio and that
mm-hmm.
type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was very fortunate in having a couple of professors that took interest in my work and in me and so on. And, you know, it was there that I really found that I had, I think, a kind of a knack for the study of history and,
mm-hmm.
and writing history and that type of thing. So mm-hmm. I was very encouraged. And after getting my bachelor's degree there, I decided to apply to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really exactly know where I wanted to go, but
mm-hmm.
at that time I was really smitten with the idea of going to California. So
mm-hmm.
I had applied to a number of universities out there.
Mm-hmm.
And after deferring my acceptance for a year, I went out to the University of California at Riverside.
Mm-hmm.
And once I was there, I was at that point, I was still kind of trying to decide if I wanted to focus in German history or Russian history. I'd
mm-hmm.
become interested in Russian history while I was an undergrad
mm-hmm.
and had started reading Russian literature and studying Russian and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So as I said, I got out to the University of California at Riverside, and the Soviet historian out there was at the time J.R. Sketty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I ended up working under him for the just over 2 years that I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting because, of course, Arch's book on the purges had come out not too long before that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was getting a lot of attention. There was a lot of controversy and so
mm-hmm.
on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't really plan it that way, and I didn't really realize it so much at the time, but I realized I was there at the sort of cutting edge of
mm-hmm.
revisionism and so on
mm-hmm.
and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And what years were these?
So I stayed, let's see, I guess I was out there from 1989 to 1991.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see, okay.
And there were some funding problems, and there were some other problems and so on. It's a sort of a typical story. So
yeah.
Even though I had intended to go for a PhD, I stayed long enough to get a master's degree
uh-huh.
and with a couple of other courses. But then I left and took some time off and worked in the private sector. Went back east and worked for a software hardware company in Cambridge, Mass, and so on.
Uh-huh.
Contemplated going to law school and trying to sort of flesh out my life.
Everybody does.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You know, where am I going?
Yeah.
But a few couple year or two in the private sector convinced me that I wanted to go back to school to get my PhD.
Uh-huh.
And so I had applied earlier to Brown University based upon my reading of Abbot Gleason's book,
mm-hmm.
Young Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't gotten accepted the first time, but I applied again. I went down and had a second interview with Abbot, or Tom, as he prefers to be
mm-hmm.
known. And to my great good fortune, I got accepted into the program.
That's great, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, so I was very happy. And then I went down. And I spent a good long time working on my PhD there. And one of the things that was really interesting is Tom was from somewhat of the older coterie of historians, Russian historians, in contrast to Arch. And I wouldn't say that Tom was part of the establishment necessarily,
mm-hmm.
but he had a slightly more traditional approach to history and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, in a sense, gave me, by having studied under these two rather different mentors, a very well-rounded approach, to be quite honest with you,
mm-hmm.
to the study of history, which I think has really benefited me in the long run, because it's kept me from perhaps approaching things in too one-sided a way
mm-hmm.
That I might have otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I said, I stayed there. I got my PhD in 2002
mm-hmm.
and spent a couple of years kicking around the states trying to find a position.
Everybody does.
Yeah. And at that time, hitting the job market, it was kind of a sad revelation to find that even with a PhD from Brown, it was going to be enormously hard to find a permanent position
anymore. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So... I was applying to, just almost anything that came along,
mm-hmm.
and I was in central Pennsylvania when the position came up for the University of Queensland,
mm-hmm.
For which I seemed tailor-made and so on, and
mm-hmm.
I'd never even imagined visiting Australia, but I went ahead and applied, and one thing led to another, and before I knew it, I was on a plane down here for an interview,
uh-huh.
and then I was offered the position.
Uh-huh.
I had to work out some details and so on.
Uh-huh.
But suffice it to say that I arrived here for what was the beginning of the second semester of 2003.
Uh-huh.
Which here, of course, everything's obverse because we're south of the equator.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah. How have you enjoyed it so far?
Well, it's been pretty good. I mean, Australia's got a lot of things going for it. There are a lot of things that make it, I think, in many ways, a more equitable society.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are some things that give it a significant advantage in terms of livability
mm-hmm.
Compared to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
The university itself it has a lot of potential,
mm-hmm.
And we're in the process sort of a kind of generational turnover,
mm-hmm.
you might say, in history.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a move by the council running the university and so on, and the new vice chancellor, as he's called, who's
mm-hmm.
the equivalent of the president of a university in the States,
mm-hmm.
to enhance the research profile of
mm-hmm.
the arts and so on. And so that's very encouraging.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gotten support for my research endeavors, and my teaching load is quite reasonable and
mm-hmm.
so on.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of potential here, and I think it's only going to get better.
Yeah, I have had several friends who have taught in Australia, and they've all had a really good time, and most of them are still there, to be honest with you. I taught in Ireland for a year and quite enjoyed that, and I also found that that it was a particularly good place to do research, and my teaching load was quite light, and it was all in all pretty enjoyable, I would say, and I think it kind of enriched me as a historian, having had the opportunity to teach abroad. It gave me a renewed understanding of what American academia really is. So you'll have to come back.
Oh, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah. You'll have to come back from Australia after a while and tell us about ourselves.
that's a very interesting thing. Of course, it's like after I had spent, you know, 9 months in Russia when I was researching my dissertation, you come back to your country looking at it in an entirely different way.
That's totally, totally true.
And to be quite honest with you, you know, even though I haven't been banished to the, you know, to the outer reaches of Siberia or something, I'm still, in a sense, an exile.
Yeah, no, it's true.
And that has given me some small degree, I think, of sympathy with my historical subject.
Mm-hmm.
So
no, I think
that I'm a little bit closer to that, yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that's an interesting point, and I think it's quite right. Yes, so that's a good segue into talking about the book itself. How did you come to write it? How did you choose this topic?
Well, when I was still at UCR, they hired Stephen Frank mm-hmm. to be the Imperial Russian historian, and mm-hmm. he's since gone along with Arch Getty to UCLA,
mm-hmm.
and of course, Stephen's work concerns, or at least it did at the time, I'm not exactly sure what he's working on now, but it concerned peasant justice in the second half of the 19th century,
mm-hmm.
Peasant justice then. And so he had acquired some sort of information on the Siberian exile system, but he noted that there really was this enormous lack of scholarship on the Siberian exile system,
mm-hmm.
and he suggested to me when I was taking a seminar with him that this might be a good
mm-hmm.
topic to research and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I read George Kennan's Siberia and the Exile System.
Sure, yeah.
Of course, it was published in 1891.
Yeah.
And, you know, to my surprise, I mean, that along with just a couple of articles by Alan Wood were really almost the only things that you could find in English.
Mm-hmm.
on the Siberian exile system.
Mm-hmm.
And so I immediately recognized that, you know, here was an area that both interested me because
mm-hmm.
of, I guess I'd always had an interest in Stalinism and the Gulag. You know,
mm-hmm.
I have to confess the sort of darker things about Russian history fascinate me.
Mm-hmm.
But here was something that was both, you might say, a little bit sensational, but also at the same time clearly needed to be given attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, you know, of course, when I left UCR and was on my hiatus, I didn't really do much, though I was always reading about Russian history and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to Brown and it came time to pick a topic for my dissertation, I threw around a couple of ideas with Tom Gleason. But when I mentioned this one on the Siberian exile system, he said, "Well, that looks like something that's quite interesting."
Mm-hmm.
And at that originally at the time, the only thing that I was planning to do was actually just write about the Sakhalin penal colony,
right?
Which was erected pretty much in the 1860s, 1870s,
mm-hmm.
lasted until the Japanese invasion of 1906,
mm-hmm.
and about which I've written a couple of articles.
Mm-hmm.
But he noted as well that, you know, you've got really this whole big topic of pre-Soviet exile that no one has written about. And he said, why don't you write a dissertation about the entire thing?
Mm-hmm.
And had I known then what I know now, I might insisted that, no, I'll just do Sakhalin to start off with.
Yeah, right.
Because it became an enormous, gigantic project.
I mean,
I ended up writing a dissertation that was 600 pages long and 10-point type. So it almost buried me.
Yeah.
But, you know, even though it was a close call to kind of get out of that thing alive, I'm really glad that I did it because it's provided a kind of basis upon which I'm extrapolating a lot of, along with some additional, you know, research, considerable additional research, I'm extrapolating out of that a lot of the material, And of course, the book that has just come out is based on the first chapters of that dissertation.
Uh-huh.
I intend to write these two more books.
Oh, is that right?
Our history.
I didn't know that. That's good. Well, when those come out, you'll have to be on the show. You have to promise.
Well, I hope I will. Yeah.
It's actually funny because we had Alex Rabinowitz on the show, and he, as you probably know, wrote three books on the Russian Revolution.
Yeah, I was just listening to some of his interviews.
Yeah, and you know, so we have a tradition of that kind of thing.
I've always been, you know, ever since I read J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, right, yeah, multi-books.
I always thought that there's something magical about writing a trilogy.
It's true. No, you know, Germans say all good things come in threes. So
yeah,
I think it's quite true. The genesis of the book then is your interest at Riverside in the topic and your talks with Arch and Tom Gleason, and then you write the dissertation.
And Stephen Frank
as well. Yes, that's right. And so then why don't we go directly to the book itself and explain? Yeah, actually, it's funny because I have kind of an anecdote about this. I remember I was in Russia once and I asked a friend of mine who knows everything about Russian history what the difference between Silka, which means exile, and Katorga was, and he looked at me and said, "I have no idea."
Yeah.
What did it, I don't know, and I thought this was just something everybody would know. So why don't you why don't you actually begin by talking a little bit about how Siberia came to be a place in the Muscovite period, I guess it was, where people were sent.
Yeah, well, you know, of course, you've got the traditional story of Yermak, the conqueror of Siberia, moving across the Urals in 1582 and defeating the Sibir Khanate.
Mm-hmm.
And this begins this very rapid march across the entire subcontinent by the Russians and the Cossacks and so on. And one of the things that I point out is that it's not generally realized that in the space of a little more than 100 years, the Russians acquired a territory that was equal to North and South America combined.
Yeah, that's an astounding fact.
It's truly an astounding fact.
Yeah.
I mean, they were all the way at the Kamchatka Peninsula by 1700.
Uh-huh.
So they have this enormous territory that they acquire in almost one fell swoop and so on. And what I found was that from the very beginning, they are faced with this kind of problem with getting people out there, because at the very time that the Muscovite state is expanding imperialistically, it's also internally developing serfdom apace, serfing the peasants and so on. And so the potential pool of migrants are being tied down to the land, and they're not being made available to serve as servitors or settlers or agriculturalists or whatnot for this new expanded territory. So what the state begins to do is to produce, in the way that I describe it, in a sort of Foucauldian sense, it begins to produce criminals.
Mm-hmm.
It begins to enact a great deal of legislation, particularly with the promulgation of the 1649 law code, the Uloženie, which really creates, in Yevgeny Anisimov's phrase, the foundings for a totalitarian state.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that's, you know, a little bit of an exaggeration. I'm not really a big fan of the term totalitarianism, but you do definitely see after 1649 a greatly expanding bureaucracy and an expanding body of legislation that makes all kinds of different violations punishable by exile.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting as well at this time is that basically with the 1649 Uloženie, the death penalty is de facto replaced by exile during this period.
Mm-hmm.
So even though people are still being exiled or being executed for quite some time, for the most part, even murderers, people who do these very horrible things, are perhaps mutilated and they're flogged and so on. They might have their nostrils ripped out. They might be tattooed on their face. But nonetheless, they are put into chains and they are marched you know, 2,000, 3,000 kilometers into the heart of Siberia, where they're going to be made to serve the Tsar as a settler, or in many cases as a Cossack, or as a mm-hmm. as a state servitor or something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that I'm pointing out in the book is that we're not really dealing with the development of exile as a penal mechanism so mm-hmm. much. Rather, it's a mechanism for statecraft. It's a mechanism mm-hmm. of economic manipulation
mm-hmm.
and what I call the commodification of the criminal body and
mm-hmm.
so on
mm-hmm.
for the purpose of satisfying the state's various status goals, economic goals, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one thing that we need to kind of – I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think one thing we kind of need to be clear about here in order to sort of make this situation understandable to – many of our American listeners, but maybe even some listeners in Australia, is that you know, people will naturally draw a parallel between the American expansion across the continent and the Russian expansion across Siberia. But in fact, they were very different in many ways. So maybe you could speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, I Eva Maria Stolberg has in her work applied Frederick Jackson Turner's thesis to Siberia, and argues that this is a useful way for understanding Russian expansion in the area. And I have to say I rather disagree with her.
Uh-huh.
I think that there were a number of differences, and one of them is the fact that you really, for the most part, don't have a class of kind of yeoman uh-huh. farmers that go
yeah,
out
right.
into Siberia.
Mm-hmm.
From the very beginning, the state is there with its officials, and the Muscovite apparatus, as you know, was quite efficient
mm-hmm.
in many ways,
mm-hmm.
And they were very efficient, remarkably, in getting people out to Siberia very quickly and controlling and dictating settlements
mm-hmm.
where you could go and where you couldn't go,
mm-hmm.
and so on. And even as it's been pointed out by recent historians, they were concerned with protecting the indigenous people against incursion. So
mm-hmm.
that further limited where people could settle.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other big thing, of course, is that in contradistinction to the American experience, you just, you know, you don't have anything parallel to the exile system.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a few Native Americans that are sent out, of course, on the Trail of Tears
mm-hmm.
and so on, but you know, their numbers are, however terrible that was, their numbers are only in the few thousands.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas during the period that I look at, between the late 1580s and 1822, it's hard to figure numbers because data is very hit or miss.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that certainly at least 500,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
were exiled to Siberia against their will.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that, again, you know, you just don't have in the American experience.
Mm-hmm.
So the frontier thesis, I don't think, really applies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see what you mean. I think another thing to point out, and you pointed out in your book, and I was kind of surprised, to be honest with you, is that this massive territory, as you say, equal to both North and South America, was incredibly sparsely populated. There really were
very few indigenes out there to begin with.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, even once you begin to settle it, you know, it's still fairly sparsely populated by the early 19th century.
Uh-huh.
So all the more reason, this is why the autocracy wants to try to get as many usable bodies out there as it possibly can.
Right.
Because the big thing is, and I should have mentioned this from the very beginning, the major draw...
Yeah, I was going to ask.
For Russians into Siberia is the fur trade.
Mm-hmm.
It's furs that make the Muscovite state the powerhouse that it became.
Mm-hmm.
It's furs that allow for Ivan the Terrible and these other rulers of Moscow to pay for their armies and,
mm-hmm.
and engage in their wars and so on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this fur, you know, Siberia itself is a bounty of furs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are sable, there are fox, there
mm-hmm.
are marmots and all, martens, I guess they're called, and all kinds of different
mm-hmm.
things.
Mm-hmm.
So with the collapse of the Sibir Khanate, the Russians take over what had been the Sibir Khanate's collection of furs from its various vassals
mm-hmm.
amongst these small peoples, as they're known, the indigenous people.
Mm-hmm.
of Siberia.
Mm-hmm.
And this becomes really the main reason initially for Muscovy to go into Siberia. And they need to send people there to extract the furs from the Siberian people through all the different ways that, you know, this is done by taking hostages and
mm-hmm.
raping and pillaging and that
yeah.
type of thing.
Right. So
and,
I was going to say, then the standard pattern is for the government to identify a place where they want to put a fortress of some sort, an Ostrog,
yeah.
as I think it's called, and then they would send servitors
Ostrog,
out there.
Yeah.
And they would send servitors out there to build what was basically a stockade. And then they would send exiles out there to do most of the menial, I guess what we might call the menial labor, which would include cropping and, construction and road repair and that kind of thing.
Well, up until Peter's reign, up until 1689, exiles performed essentially two main functions. And what was interesting is that I found is that most exiles prior to 1649 were, and their numbers were fairly small, but most of these people were prisoners of war
mm-hmm.
that had been captured in Muscovy's wars, in the Baltics and with Poland, Lithuania, and so
mm-hmm.
on. And they were sent out as kind of drafted into the Cossacks and other servitor groups in Siberia.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were sent out to strong arm the indigenes into handing over their weapons caches
mm-hmm.
and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Not that, but their fur caches. And, so
mm-hmm.
on.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that you needed, though, is because these people need to be fed and the supply lines are so long back to Moscow or anywhere else in European Russia, you need to have an indigenous agricultural base.
Right.
Now, initially, they try to get the indigenes to do this, but these people are nomads and they don't want to sit around farming and,
right.
and getting their food.
Yeah.
Russia. So what you do then is you begin to exile increasing numbers of not only Russians, but Ukrainians and other peoples who are being captured as Russia begins to expand. You send them out, and they are assigned to these locales to produce food that is then going to be used to feed the non-food producing
uh-huh.
Russians that are in the region.
Uh-huh.
So that situation prevails until you get to Peter's reign. Then what happens is it's really interesting because it's indicative of, if you will, the efficiency of the Muscovite system that already by the end of the 17th century, a lot of the fur-bearing animals or mammals, if you will, of Siberia are
mm-hmm.
becoming extinct.
Really?
There is such an enormously efficient extraction of furs during this period that the Russians have managed to bring several species to this state of extinction by the end of the 1700s, or the end of the 1600s. So what occurs at this time as well is something that's very interesting, and this is the discovery of valuable minerals and so on, metals
mm-hmm.
and so on,
mm-hmm.
in the Baikalia, Trans-Baikalia, east of the Lake Baikal. And so now begins a different phase in Siberia's history, and this is the extraction not only of furs, but of mineral resources and metallurgy.
Uh-huh.
And this also begins the process, the introduction of katorga, which
mm-hmm.
is penal labor. And I insist on using the Russian term in the book because katorga was itself a kind of penological administrative construct
mm-hmm.
that not only just was hard labor in the way that we would think of it in the West, but was really an entire administrative apparatus.
Mm-hmm.
It gets created by Peter for the purposes of improving Russia's war-making capacity.
Mm-hmm.
So during this period, iron works are established in the Urals. Silver mines begin to be established in Nerchinsk, east of Baikal. And lead is being mined as well, and all these things, of course, are necessary for you to be able to fight your wars against Sweden and
mm-hmm.
and the other powers in Europe. So this creates a very much more utilitarian use, I guess you'd say, of criminals during
mm-hmm.
this period. And there is this remarkable document that I found that had been in a collection that was published early in the 20th century, a document written in Peter's own hand saying, "We need 2,000 convicts quick. Go find them from the from the various town councils and the various districts. In other words, deliver me 2,000 convicts." And so, again, there is nothing more indicative of producing penal laborers than this very revealing document.
Right.
And this creates a body of manipulable labor that for the most part is actually used at building sites, as far as I can tell, at building sites in European Russia, until we get Catherine II's reign, which begins in 1762. And it's during that period that after the big building projects have essentially been accomplished in European Russia, the main body of penal laborers is moved solidly out to Nerchinsk, which by now has become quite an interesting complex and series of different plants and factories and so on for the extraction of various metals and their smelting and so on, and then their production into various goods that are then, as I said, shipped back to European Russia for use in war making.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, then, you're also getting into a period where there is a need to colonize Siberia because of what is believed to be the looming threat from China and to the borders. Because China, of course, is much more populous. It's just over the border.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a reasonable claim to moving into this kind of empty space to the north. The Russians are faced with having this big empty space and not enough bodies to fill it.
Right.
So they want to secure this area, and moreover, to protect the important metals that they're now extracting from that.
Mm-hmm.
So there becomes a concerted use to get bodies out there in any way you can. And this initiates another very interesting development in the history of exile, which is the development of administrative exile.
Mm-hmm.
In basically beginning in 1760, a couple of years before Catherine takes the throne, and then to which she adds afterwards with subsequent legislation, administrative exile is something that the sovereigns give the power over to landowners and also peasant communes that allows them to deport to Russia serfs or fellow peasants without having to legally accuse them of a crime or to get them convicted in a court. Mm-hmm. So all you've got to do is essentially say that Ivan Ivanov is a bad guy, and that's the phrase in Russian was "dernaya povedenie," bad behavior, which kind of covers covers anything you want. So you label somebody as being of bad behavior, and you turn them over to the government, and they'll march that poor bastard out into the middle of Syria and make use of him.
Right.
Now, what happens is this. Is encouraged by the government to the tune of actually paying landowners to hand over serfs.
Oh, really?
The landowners were getting, I forget the exact figures, but I think they got something like 10 rubles for each male serf, 5 rubles for a boy, and half those for females, and so on. There is this, as I put it in the book, this sort of Gogolian speculation in living souls, which is a further commodification of these bodies. It completely undermines any sort of penological basis or judicial basis for sending these poor people out there. But it is a process that grows apace so that by the time you get to the 19th century, fully half of the million or so people that were exiled in the space of the final century of the Romanov dynasty are sent there without ever having been accused of or convicted of a crime.
Mm-hmm.
It's just this enormous, violation of human dignity.
So,
human dignity.
So was there any chance that these people could come back? I mean, was their term limited in any way?
Well, yeah, you did have, in the case of administrative exile, as it develops in the 19th century, let's say, and this is a little outside the period covered by the book, but in the space of the 19th century, administrative exile is supposed to be only for 5 years. But what happens is once these people are sent out there, the only way that they can come back at the expiry of their term is if they pay for it themselves. And the government's not going to, in other words, bring them back on its own coin. So by the time these people get out there and they have either settled or not, or oftentimes they just become beggars and so on, they just don't have the means. So they're stuck, you know, and the government knows this, you know. So the other thing, too, is you do have people that begin to get exiled, more specifically to Silka, which is a judicial sentence of exile. And these people are assigned as posilienci, as settlers. Posilienci, so exiled settlers. And that's a specific judicial category to which people do get convicted to. And they do get assigned to settlements. The terms would vary, but if those people were convicted, part of their sentence held that even after they had served their criminal sentence, they could never return to European Russia. So the and similarly too with the sentence of katorgos, heavy labor, penal labor. So the intent behind these two things, these two judicial sentences, was clearly that after these people had paid their debt to society, so to speak, they would still have to serve as settlers within Siberia.
I see. What
I know, this is a ridiculously broad question, but we have this image in our mind of Siberia being this tremendously harsh and horrible place. What were conditions like for many of these people?
Well, they were harsh and horrible for many. So it is sometimes. Yeah, I mean, there's no two ways about it. But I mean, the other thing too is you do have to remember that for the most part, settlement, even to this day in Siberia, is along the narrow southern band of the region. So even though, you know, a good portion of Siberia, for example, is tundra, there are very, very few people that live up in those harsh conditions. Then you have this narrow band, which is this huge coniferous forest known as the taiga. But even still, most people live at a latitude that is the equal of or even below that of Moscow or Petersburg or something. Nonetheless, I mean, it is bloody cold out there. I mean, when I was, I arrived in Irkutsk on the Trans-Siberian Railroad. I'd been in Vladivostok researching there for several months, and then I took the train to Irkutsk. And I arrived in Irkutsk something like the first or second day of January. And it was a cold spell there, and it was minus 30 degrees to 35 degrees Fahrenheit or Celsius, because of that temperature, Fahrenheit and Celsius actually converge. And, you know, that's pretty cold.
That's cold,
When you're outside in that temperature, you can feel your eyeballs begin to congeal.
Yeah, I imagine,
And to blink a lot. Spit freezes the minute it hits the sidewalk. The air freezes. There's this kind of weird phenomenon where the moisture in the air will freeze, and so you're walking in this kind of cloud-like thing and stuff. So you actually feel your body, for every second that you're outside, you feel your body slowly kind of dying, and you knew, and you know that you've got to get in at a certain point, because otherwise you're not going to last, no matter how warmly you're dressed.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, the people that were sent out there were not given down jackets or anything, so they were subjected to the worst of these climatic you know, variables that you can imagine. And then, of course, you know, these people got to march out there in chains.
Right.
And so, again, we don't have exact figures for the period that I cover in this book. I've got some figures for the late 19th century. But I think that it's fair to estimate that at least, you know, a quarter of the people who were sent to Siberia prior to 1822 died before ever reaching their destination.
Uh-huh. You know? That's interesting. Yeah. So did the government attempt to actually say, I mean, you know, there's lots of, this is a little bit outside the chronological framework of the book, but did the government send women out there as well in the hopes that they might be fruitful and multiply?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, very much so. And what you and in fact, this falls squarely within the period covered by the book.
Okay.
You have in the documentation, it's quite explicitly stated that they're going to round up women in European Russia and ship them out mm-hmm. en masse to Siberia, and explicitly to serve as wives for Cossacks and officers
mm-hmm.
and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And this was done right up to into the early 19th century, and then too you also had a situation where the government was so desperate to give these men wives because females were seen as a civilizing component.
Mm-hmm.
There was the trope that man was a wild beast he would engage
yeah.
in dubious sexual practices and even worse, and that you had to get these women out there so that this this frontier, you know, wild society could be tamed.
Mm-hmm.
And so the government bent all efforts towards doing something to resolve this, and it offered early into the 19th century inducements for local tribespeople and the small number of indigenous Russian peasants that were there to sell their daughters or sisters or so on
mm-hmm.
To exiles
mm-hmm.
as their wives.
Mm-hmm.
So there was again this commodification, this speculation in human individuals that was going on for females as well.
Mm-hmm.
At most, though, of course, the women were always a small minority of the total exilic population
mm-hmm.
just because not going to have that many women being listed as criminals.
Mm-hmm.
But they were paired with male convicts quite consciously and
mm-hmm.
intentionally.
Mm-hmm. I suspect that the data are so few that you won't be able to answer this question, but was there any natural increase among the Russian population that is the exilic population that was sent out there, or was it all the result of more people being sent?
Well, that's a good question. There's a debate about this, and not surprisingly, historians during the Soviet era, and I suspect Russian historians today, are loath to admit that they are the descendants of exiles,
mm-hmm.
and that exile, you know, theirs is a land of exiles and so on. And in fact, it wasn't. Even though we had a lot of exiles being sent to Siberia, at no time, and this is important to stress, at no time did exiles constitute a majority of the population
mm-hmm.
overall.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I would say they never constituted more than perhaps 10-15% of the total population of
mm-hmm.
Siberia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things, I mean, I tend to think that they actually left few descendants.
Uh-huh.
And the reason that I think this is, first of all, that most of them were males.
Uh-huh.
A lot of them were people who were mentally or physically handicapped.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of them escaped.
Uh-huh.
And you just... You know, and moreover, the percentage of them who were indeed actually criminals,
mm-hmm.
that is to say, people who weren't wrongly accused but really had done the things that they did, were in all likelihood not the type of people who would settle down and raise families.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think, in other words, that they contributed materially to the Russian population.
Mm-hmm.
What they did do, and this is a point that I make in the book, is that when they escaped, when they fled their assigned locations, which they did quite frequently and quite easily, they helped to spread the various diseases and so on
mm-hmm.
throughout the native population
mm-hmm.
that served to depopulate
mm-hmm.
the indigenous population of Siberia.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, it led to the preponderance much faster of the Russian population.
Mm-hmm.
So theirs was not so much of an addition to the Russian population, but they functioned more as a force that detracted from the indigenous population through spreading diseases and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. How did the government keep these people in exile?
That's really an honest question. I don't know. How did they prevent them from escaping and make sure that they did the work that they were assigned to do?
Yeah, well, the glib answer is, in fact, oftentimes they didn't.
Yeah. I mean,
there were enormously high escape rates.
Uh-huh.
And one of the only ways that they could do it was by sending them to such a remote location that there was really kind of nowhere for them to go. That,
uh-huh.
In other words, they escaped out of the settlement, they would simply die of exposure in the Tiger or something.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So that was one way. There were, of course, Cossacks and police that were generally in the area, and especially at the Katorga sites, where the mines and the,
mm-hmm.
and the smelteries were located, you did have detachments of both indigenous and Cossack troops and so on. But I've found a great deal of data. And in fact, all of Chapter 4, almost much of Chapter 4,
mm-hmm.
deals with the really interesting material I found in the Irkutsk archive about the great number of people who were fleeing from locations all throughout Siberia and so
mm-hmm.
on. And there just wasn't simply the manpower
mm-hmm.
necessary to keep these people in place.
Mm-hmm.
So you had escape rates that were probably on the order of about 25 to 50% of any given factory's workforce
mm-hmm.
per year. And so it necessitated having to constantly replenish
right.
these workforces with further and further groups of exiles because there was almost no way to keep them where they were.
Mm-hmm. Are there a lot of
I was going to say about these documents is, you know, you're in the age, of course, before photographs, so
right.
you've got all these archival documents that are essentially, most wanted posters.
Yeah,
and stuff.
Right.
And they're listing all the physical details.
Yeah.
Characteristics by which you can identify these escapees.
Uh-huh, I see.
And so you've got people, and you know that these people have been previously sentenced to Katorga because they are described as having their noses ripped off
right.
or being branded
mm-hmm.
or having lash scars all over them and
mm-hmm.
so on. And so this is a clear indication that these people have been scourged before they were exiled.
Mm-hmm.
But it's oftentimes hard to tell as well from the archival documents if the escapees described are exiles themselves or just, for example, soldiers
mm-hmm.
who are fleeing their impressment or
mm-hmm.
Various settlers or so on who are fleeing the authorities or something. But
mm-hmm.
there was a great deal of flight throughout Siberia. It was a real wild east in many ways,
mm-hmm.
and there was a great deal of demographic fluidity in the area
mm-hmm.
for the whole period
mm-hmm.
that I was.
Yeah, I imagine. So how did the government in Moscow or Petersburg attempt to control the settlements that they had created? In other words, it seems to me that these places would be
quite corrupt. Is that correct?
They were corrupt.
Yeah.
and that's another thing that I look at in the book is the venality of the Siberian bureaucracy and
uh-huh.
so on. One of the things that's important to remember is, you know, Russia, even to the present, of course, is a hard place to govern just simply because it's so darn big.
Yeah.
And it would oftentimes take, it would oftentimes take like 2 years for an instruction issued by the sovereign in
yeah.
Moscow
uh-huh.
to reach the governor of Irkutsk or
yeah,
something.
Yeah. Right.
And then by the time it arrived, of course, the governor in Irkutsk would say, well, this situation to which it refers doesn't apply anymore, or just pretend that he never received the instruction.
Right.
And he could basically snub his nose at Moscow or Petersburg and say, well, what are you going to do about it? You can't come and get me.
Right. Exactly.
So what you had was very soon developing within Siberia these regional satrapies,
yeah.
and these are terms that were used by contemporaries to refer to the various governors in their different locales and so
mm-hmm,
on.
Yeah.
And they themselves, the various governors would do interesting things. For example, you have a number of accounts where they would impress hapless exiles into forming their own sort of hussar regiment and lead them into various wars against fellow governors and that. And then you had this other character, Ivan Zheglov, I think his name was, if I remember right, and he was a servitor in the late 17th century in Yakutia, way up near Yakutsk. And even though this guy worked for the government, supposedly, his main bag was to go around and take people hostage in the villages and use their take them hostage to force them to buy the beer, which incidentally is stolen in any case from Ivan Pivovarov, that is to say Ivan of the Brewers, who had made the beer in the first place, and Zheglov would run this racket, this extortion hostage taking racket, for years. He was never brought to justice. And then the interesting thing as well is that he passed on the practices to his son, who continued the family tradition.
That's excellent.
So the whole history of dubious governing practices vis-a-vis the inhabitants of Siberia is very old. It dates from the very beginning, and it continued throughout the entire period up until 1917, at least.
I see. So let me ask this. Catherine the Great, whom all of our listeners will know, she was a German lady, and she was quite enlightened. She corresponded with all the philosophers and so on and so forth. Was there ever any attempt in her reign or thereafter to reform any of these people, or was the entire object a kind of cynical attempt to extract various sorts of valuable things from Siberia and have them flow back to Moscow?
Well, Catherine is this really interesting figure, because we all know that, like you say, she was influenced by the philosophes, she was influenced by Beccaria and Montesquieu and other people who had written on penal reform and so on. And during her reign, she does institute legislation that is meant to ameliorate the lot for exiles. For example, she issues an order that those who fell sick on the march to Siberia would be repaired to a hospital, would be given medical attention. She also supported a clarification of sentences and the issuing of paperwork that would supposedly make sure that there were no confusions that would result in, for example, someone who had been sentenced to administrative exile ending up in a katorga site and vice versa. She also ordered that the flogging with the knout, which was a terrible instrument that, that oftentimes resulted in death for the condemned person, would be abolished, and people would now merely be branded on the face. And also, too, I think she abolished the slitting of nostrils, which is another kind of horrible form of scourging to mark prisoners and so on. But the thing that I point out in the book as well is that Catherine was very good at sometimes issuing these pronunciamentos that had a humanitarian gloss to them, but she was much, much worse at seeing them through or providing the funding for these things. And so the problem was is that whereas a lot of these things sounded good on paper, they were very rarely actually put into practice. And again, here comes in the issue of geography. Is, how do you really keep control over a bunch of illiterate, brutal guards out in central eastern Siberia who don't give a damn what they say in Petersburg. And they don't have to, because there's no way they can be brought, to responsibility. There is another thing, too, that happens very interestingly, is during the Pugachev uprising in 1774, when this peasant led a bunch of Cossacks to, try to overthrow the monarchy and so on. There had been a number of people that were exiled to Siberia, and the problem was is that a number of these exiles were actually joining Pugachev's army and marching on Kazan and other places. And it was at this point that that Catherine actually issued an ukaz that abolished exile. Now, principally, this was for the reasons that I just explained. But at the same time, she also began to develop the notion of creating a series of prisons that would be loosely modeled on the prisons that were then beginning to appear in Europe and in the United States for reforming people.
Mm-hmm.
And this suggests a possibility for a much different direction in Russia's penal history.
Mm-hmm.
From that point onward. However, like with these other things, she failed to provide the funding for it. So as far as I could tell, none of these prisons came into existence, with the possible exception of one. And even for that, I didn't find much evidence.
Uh-huh.
So she was a person of kind of high ideals, but at the end of the day, I came away with a rather jaundiced picture of Catherine the Great, one that stands at odds, for example, with the picture that her biographer, Isabel de Madariaga, paints of her as a very kind of humanitarian ruler. I found quite a different picture to come out of her with regard especially to the treatment of exiles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Russia is a great place for destroying people's ideals.
it makes you a little bit cynical.
Yeah, no, well, a lot of ideals have entered, and I don't believe any of them have come out unscathed. Let me ask this.
Yeah.
Why do you end the book in 1822?
Well, 1822 is a very important turning point. After you have a series of very corrupt governors in eastern Siberia, and this results in problems that are so profound, not only with regard to the treatment of exiles, but mostly in terms of the governance of much of Siberia, that Petersburg and Alexander the First finally realized that something needs to be done systematically to deal with this problem. And in other words, it's not simply a matter of appointing a new governor,
mm-hmm.
but it's a matter of reconfiguring the governance of Siberia.
Mm-hmm.
And so he picks his favorite counselor, Mikhail Speransky, who, of course, was very significant in the establishment of ministerial government beginning in 1802,
mm-hmm.
had helped establish the Ministry of Internal Affairs, had been working for a while on a kind of aborted constitution for Siberia, for Russia,
mm-hmm.
and had, however, fallen into trouble because of his Francophilism during the war with France. He was now given, in a sense, a chance to return to favor by being ordered, you might say, to serve as Eastern Siberia's governor.
Mm-hmm.
He goes out with plenipotentiary powers in 1819 to Irkutsk, and he sees all the corruption there. He gets rid of hundreds of officials, manages to get some of them taken into court, and has others arrested, though not much happens with regard to justice in these things. But he sees that Siberia is a unique place within
mm-hmm.
the empire,
mm-hmm.
and that therefore it needs to have a unique set of regulations. And so this leads in 1822 to the formation of the 1822 Siberian reforms that he concocts along with the so-called Siberian Committee. And I end it here because to me it represents a transition into the bureaucratization of the
mm-hmm.
of the Tsarist state that really incorporates the ideals of the police state that had come to fruition earlier in places like Prussia,
mm-hmm.
Where there was a real effort here, and this is embodied in the regulations that I look at in some length in this final chapter, to socially engineer these exiles to become useful members of society.
That's interesting.
And Speransky was very influenced by German philosophy, and he sincerely believed that the state could use its powers to re-educate and make people into not necessarily good people, because in a sense this is now going beyond good and evil,
uh-huh.
but to make them useful people,
uh-huh.
to make them purposeful for the purposes of the state.
Uh-huh.
And what I see in this document is that even with the best intentions, you might say, you have the bases here for the enormous social engineering experiments of the 20th century.
Yeah, it's
very insidious. It's very scary because, of course, you can see that the road to hell was paved with good intentions. I think Speransky, you know, in his heart felt that he was a good man and that he felt he was doing something that was good for the state. And, of course, in the early 19th century, the state was seen as something that was unapologetically good. There was no problem with it. But it shows that in the very conceptualization of this entity, there are going to be some serious problems for the human rights of individuals and society as a whole.
Yeah, no, I see. That's interesting that it presages or kind of foreshadows what happens later in the 20th
century. It
really does.
Yeah,
and remarkable.
It's almost like you're writing a script or something. Of course, with the benefit of hindsight, historians can write anything they want.
Right.
But it does eerily prefigure the experiments after 1917 in Russia.
That's very interesting. Well, Andrew, I want to say thank you very much. We've taken up a heck of a lot of your time, and we really appreciate it. Let me close the interview by asking you what has become our traditional question, and that is, what is your next project, or what are you working on now?
Well, I've got two things. I'm trying to finish and putting through what I hope is its final draft, a translation of the reporter Vlas Doroshevich's memoirs or reportages, reportorial reports from his visit to the Sakhalin penal colony in 1897.
Mm-hmm.
And these various reports that he sent back to the newspaper Odesky Listok were compiled in book form and published in 1903.
Mm-hmm.
And it's never been translated into English, and so I'm finishing that, and that's due to come out from Anthem Press in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing I'm working on is part two of this trilogy that I mentioned.
That's great.
And this will cover the period of Siberian exile from 1823 to 1861, and 1861 is significant, of course, because that marks the beginning of the Great Reform.
Yeah, I'm so envious of this long-term project because I always just am terrified when I finish something because I have absolutely no idea what I'm going to do. And so I spend a year I have no idea whether I'm worth anything or I'm a fraud.
I feel like I'm bound to this project that I enjoy what I do, but at the same time, I want to finish it because there are a lot of other things I want to do.
Yeah,
but
I
do think it's very important.
Well, I really wish you luck with that, and I want to thank you again for writing a terrific book, Exile to Siberia, 1590 to 1822. And, Andrew, thanks very much for being on the show.
Well, thank you again, Marshall. I appreciate it.
Sure, it's my pleasure. Bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Andrew Gentes about his new book, Exile to Siberia, 1590 to 1822. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. Hope you have a great week.